You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
I'm Wilfred Frost. Here's what's ahead. From Microsoft to Eli Lilly to Lennar and Etsy, there are all-time highs in almost every sector. Are we looking at a frothy market or are earnings justifying the levels that we're seeing? Plus, the clouds are parting. Alaska Air posting a loss today, but says they're seeing signs of brighter days ahead. We'll speak to their CEO. And the latest report on consumer confidence is sending a strong message to the housing market. We'll tell you what it is ahead. But we begin today with the broader markets picture. And Dom Chu, as ever, has that for us. Hey, Dom.
So, Wilfred, we have lost a little bit of momentum right now. Because at the highs of the session, yes, the Dow Industrials are just about flat right now. But earlier in the day, we were up roughly 161 points. So that gives you a little bit of an idea there of how far we've kind of come back here. Not crazy, but still a little bit of slowing momentum. And we've backed off some of those record highs that we've seen even earlier today and certainly from the close of business yesterday as well. One place, again, that has backed off highs but did set a record one earlier today, which is why I'll put the little yellow star up here, the gold one, is the 27% gain over the last year in the iShares U.S. Home Construction ETF. Some earnings reports today in the housing sector really helping to propel that particular move higher in these housing stocks. And remember, since the pandemic lows almost a year ago, we're up roughly 165% in this particular home construction ETF. So, again, a trend to watch. Even though we are lower on the day, it did set a record high not long after the opening bell. And then probably the stock story of the day. We've been focusing so much on GameStop, some of these highly shorted ones. Check out shares of Beyond Meat, up 17% right now. By the way, that is well off the highs from earlier. We were up close to 30% at one point today. There is actually a fundamental news catalyst to this, Wilfred, in that they are now teaming up in a joint venture with PepsiCo, the consumer products giant, to jointly develop plant-based snacks and drinks. That's helping to carry those shares higher, a real kind of breakout over the near-term downtrends that we've seen for Beyond Meat. So still, Wilfred, some fundamental stories driving some of the upside in Beyond Meat today. I'll send things back over to you.
Fundamental factor there in terms of deal news for that one, Dom. Also, some other fundamental factors out there, given that we're, of course, into earnings season very meaningfully today. What's the key takeaway so far from those companies that have reported today?
So, yes, still early in this busiest week of earnings season. But one trend that we are seeing, although a small one, is more and more companies are actually giving some forward guidance with regard to their operations. Now, it's not near term. It's not this coming quarter, but the full year is kind of in focus here. So a number of companies actually starting to say, hey, we're going to give you some adjusted profit guidance for the full year because maybe they do see a light at the end of the tunnel, things normalizing this year. We are seeing very little color commentary because, again, a lot of uncertainty there, but we are getting actual quantifiable guidance, meaning companies are actually saying, hey, expect this kind of range for our operating profits, our adjusted profits. That's something to watch here. And by the way, check out these stocks because these five stocks are important. Apple, Tesla, Boeing, Facebook, and AT&T, among the stocks left to report at some point this week. And the reason why I want to highlight these, aside from the fact that you know that Facebook, Tesla, and Apple are all within the top five or six stocks in the S&P, all together, these particular stocks overall make up roughly 12% of the market cap of the S&P 500. You throw Microsoft in after the bell today, Wilfred, I know you're watching that one. It's 17% of the S&P 500 in just those six names. That's why they're going to be so key. Back over to you.
Dom, thanks so much for that. Certainly we'll be watching Microsoft tonight. But with all these companies reporting, does it give investors a slightly clearer picture of what 2021 could look like? Does it mean the rally will keep going or that the numbers aren't good enough for valuations? Let's welcome in Neil Hennessy, Portfolio Manager and Chief Investment Officer at Hennessy Funds. Neil, good to see you. Thanks so much for joining me. I mean, let's start on that broad point. Clearly, there are some signs of frothiness in markets and there's been a great run. Are the earnings, though, coming through and justifying the rallies we've seen?
Well, first of all, I don't think the market's long in the tooth. I mean, you're only talking about it selling at 20 times earnings this year and 18 times earnings next year on the Dow Jones. But if you look to last year when the pandemic hit, companies had no idea of what was going to happen, how severe it was going to be, what the turndown was going to be on profits, revenues, employees. And they weathered that storm as normal because businesses weather all kinds of storms. So when you start to look at maybe a little forward guidance, which I've never really liked personally, but essentially it's given the consumer or given the investor some confidence that the company's a little more confident that the pandemic's starting to get behind us and that the economy's going to start to open up, which will mean that more business is going to come to them.
Right. But I guess, Neil, the obvious point to note is that it's not like markets fell last year in line with earnings declining. They've already rallied almost ahead of an expectation of a bounce back in the fundamentals this year. And there are some of these signs of frothiness. Do those signs worry you when you see certain stocks soaring on single day moves?
Well, see, I don't look at the market as being frothy here. There's sectors, there's individual names that are frothy. You have to look at the NASDAQ, Wilford, from last year was up 45%. But if you took out those six stocks of Amazon, Apple, Google, Microsoft, Facebook, Tesla, the market was only up 21%. But you do have these frothy stocks. You also have a lot of investors or small investors that are in chat rooms that are chatting up companies, and there's no fundamental analysis in there. But the bottom line is there's a lot of value in this market, but there is frothiness in some of those sectors and names.
What about protection? How are you getting that for your clients at the moment? Do you still own bonds? Do you own gold, Bitcoin?
No, I don't own any bonds. I'm not a fan of bonds simply because I've always thought that bonds were a certificate of confiscation. It's a no-lose game in their long term. But essentially, if you look at the market and if you buy quality, that's how you protect yourself. If you look over the last 40 years, 33 of those years have been up years on an average of 18% a year. The 7 years that it were down over those last 40 years, they were down on average 9% a year. And the worst of it was 2001 and 02. 3 years of a bear market. Other than that, we haven't seen a bear market. We've seen volatility, we've seen corrections, but we're not headed into a bear market. But we're continuing to see some volatility in here.
So let's finish, Neil, with one of your stock picks. Tell us about KB Homes.
Well, I think KB Homes, if you look at that, it's a first-time buyer home. It's a lower-end market. You look at mortgage rates 30 years in the 3% range. Come on. Years ago when I bought my first house, I was 14.5%, 15% on mortgage with PMI insurance. So most kids in two-income families can afford a KB home out in the future. So, I like it. You know, they earn around $5 a share. They're selling at less than one on a price of sales to earning ratio. And they pay a 60-cent dividend. So there's plenty of room for upside on not only the stock, but the dividend at the same time.
Neil Hennessy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Good to see you. All three of the major averages at the moment just fractionally lower on the day. Shares of Lockheed Martin lower also after reporting weaker than expected earnings, down about 3%. Morgan Brennan has just spoken to the CEO and joins us now with some of those key takeaways. Hey, Morgan.
Hey, Wolf, that's right. So I just got off the phone with Lockheed Martin's new CEO, Jim Taiclet, as well as CFO Ken Posen-Reed and COO Frank St. John. Now, on the heels of a rare earnings miss this morning, though I should note profits still up 20% and raised guidance, I did ask Taiclet, who took the helm last summer, what a Biden administration will mean for defense spending. So Taiclet saying that while he can't predict where future budgets are going to fall, the mega trends do support a stable defense budget going forward, adding that nominations, recent appointments to key national security positions add confidence to that outlook. He also discussed his 21st century warfighter vision. This is to double down on emerging technologies amid a flatlining budget, taking an approach he really similarly wielded at Telecom American Tower to focus on 5G infrastructure and massive systems of Internet of Things. Think unmanned vehicles, drones, et cetera. By partnering with a coalition of tech and telco companies, though he wouldn't disclose those names, also focusing on AI and machine learning, and then linking that space systems and hypersonic capability to that bigger sort of emerging portfolio picture, which speaks to the $5 billion Aerojet Rocketdyne deal that was announced last month. I asked, is he still acquisitive? He said yes, but we'll be disciplined. And lastly, on a day, I should note, where Virgin Galactic is up 17%, was halted for volatility in trading just earlier today, really speaking to, I think, the investor appetite for commercial space right now. I asked how he's approaching that burgeoning field of commercial space. And he said he's already diving into those arenas in defense intelligence where small and medium-sized satellites are concerned. And that really commercial 5G infrastructure is going to include those low Earth orbit satellites over the coming decades. And also just noting some of the partnerships they have and really that space continues to be a key area of growth over the longer term, Wealth.
Morgan, thanks so much for that very detailed perspective on those numbers. Lockheed is, though, down 2.8% today. So to come here on the exchange, looking to take off shares of Alaska Air have jumped 36% in the past 3 months on growing optimism about the return of travel. We'll speak with the CEO about its latest quarter and if he sees clearer skies ahead. Plus, he's been warning about a potential mask crisis in America for years. It took a pandemic for Congress to hear him out.
Forgive me for being angry. I'm angry because I've done this for so long. And I've been ignored for so long.
We will speak with Prestige Ameritech about its fight for American-made equipment and why it could become a security issue. The exchange, back off this. Welcome back. Shares of Alaska Airlines lower today and down nearly 50% over the past 6 months after missing on revenues. But the company is remaining optimistic as the vaccine rollout continues. Phil LeBeau joins us now with the details. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Wealth, the shares just turned positive, in part coming off of the conference call, which had some fairly optimistic comments in terms of the Q1 outlook. When you look at the first quarter for Alaska Airlines, yeah, they reported a narrower than expected loss for the fourth quarter. But like all the airlines, it's not about the fourth quarter. It's about the outlook. Capacity will be down 30% in the first quarter. Its Q1 revenue is expected to be down anywhere between 60 and 65%, roughly in line with analyst expectation. And its January cash burn will come in somewhere between $100 and $125 million. Let's bring in Brad Tilden, CEO of Alaska Airlines, joining us from Seattle. All right, Brad, when you look at the first quarter, I mentioned the conference call because I noticed there was some optimism in there, especially when you look at advanced bookings. Tell me what you're expecting in terms of bringing down that cash burn to where you're cash flow positive.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Good morning. We're happy to be here. I think what Alaska is seeing, and I think other airlines are seeing this as well, but I think bookings for the month of January for the last couple of months with this third wave of coronavirus have sort of, or not bookings, but employments have sort of been flat. There's not, I think COVID has sort of kept people from coming to the airplane. But as we look forward, there is clearly people looking ahead. They're looking to the rollout of the vaccine and they're feeling, they're seeing more optimism. Our bookings for future travel are in the neighborhood of 60 to 70,000 bookings a day. That's what we've seen for the last several weeks. Versus current employments of about 40,000 people per day. So I think there is there are signs of brighter skies ahead.
Brad, you know what this brings up? I've heard from a number of friends and family members who have said, you know, I'm thinking about booking a trip maybe in June, maybe in springtime, but I am going to start booking a trip. What's going to happen with airfares? How much do you expect them to rise? Because there is an expectation that's been put out there by the website Hopper and others that we will see an increase in airfares, let's say, over the next couple of months.
Yeah, I think different airlines might respond to this differently. But at Alaska, our mentality has always been that the first thing you need to do is sort of stimulate demand, get demand. We think what you're saying, Phil, is right. People do feel cooped up. They've been held in their homes or their communities for 12 months now. They do want to get out and see other parts of the country or visit fams and friends and family. So what we will be doing is trying to stimulate demand. Our mentality will be first keep the low fares out there to fill the airplanes. And as the airplanes begin to fill, and I think this isn't a next 2-3 months. This is really more the latter part of 2021. I think you may see pricing return to normal. Nobody's thinking of sort of a different pricing environment than that right now. But I think you will see some fares and some promotional activity, probably some lower fares in the next several months. And then as airplanes fill, and we'll all see when that happens, as airplanes get more full, you'll see fares maybe return to more normal levels.
Bradley, where do you stand on requiring people on your planes to prove that they've been vaccinated, whether that is employees or passengers?
You know, we will what Alaska will do with things like that, Wilf, is we will just follow the industry trend and the industry regulations. And I would think that at some point in time, there will be some sort of indication that we're all carrying with us. But Alaska is not going to lead that effort. We are very supportive of industry practices, government practices, like requiring a face mask. We're very big time behind. So we will support whatever protocol we come up for the industry overall.
Brad, one last question here. You took delivery of your first 737 MAX. It goes into service on March 1st. How much of a game changer will that be for Alaska as you start to bring those into your fleet?
You know, it's going to be huge, Phil. We were an all 737 fleet for many, many years. When we bought Virgin America, that brought Airbus into the fleet, and that brings complexity. Your operation is less simple. You've got to have reserve pilots on both fleets and inventory and all of this stuff. So moving back to this will have us largely back to an all Boeing fleet by the summer of 2023. And I think it'll bring a lot of efficiencies. With every airplane that we bring, our fuel costs will go down, our ownership costs will go down, our maintenance costs will go down, and our revenue opportunity will increase. So this should be a real profit driver for the company.
Brad Tilden, CEO of Alaska Airlines. Brad, congratulations. This is your very last earnings after 84 earnings reports. You get to sleep
that
in.
That is true, Phil. Thanks very much. It's been an honor. It's leading the great people of Alaska has been a blessing that I never imagined would happen in my life, but it's been fantastic. And we've enjoyed the getting to know you and all of that over the years as well.
We will be in touch, I'm sure, at some point in the future. Brad Tilden. Wilf, I'll send it back to you.
Phil, thank you. Brad, our thanks and congratulations to you also. Speaking of travel, starting today, all international travelers arriving to the U.S. will need to present a negative COVID test, leaving cash-strapped tourist countries scrambling to obtain more tests. Seema Modi joins us now with that story. Hey, Seema.
Hey, Wilfred, that's right. Americans planning a trip overseas will now need to ensure that they can get access to a COVID test to avoid getting delayed on their return. United Airlines last week said the CDC ruling has already resulted in an increase in cancellations to Mexico and the Caribbean, two destinations that have seen a nice jump in bookings since last fall. Now, hotels and resorts are trying to work out a solution with a number of Marriott Hilton properties offering on-site antigen and PCR testing. Hyatt is actually covering the cost of all tests, all of this in an effort to encourage Americans to keep traveling down south. Now, one issue is staffing, getting more trained professionals to give the test out. St. Lucia, an island in the Caribbean, providing training to ensure hotels have more resources.
We have testing now available at our hotels. The medical staff at the hotel have actually been trained to take the swabs. And in private villas and smaller properties, we do have physicians that are going to be going to those properties to take the swabs. And we're able to respond within the 72 hours.
Now, for St. Lucia and the Caribbean broadly, tourism is the main driver of their economy, 65% of GDP. So, Wilfred, investing in testing facilities, easing traveler concerns, that's really critical to their livelihood. And, of course, that vaccine will be a game changer in order to get back to pre-pandemic levels. Back to you.
It's interesting, Seema. I mean, and of course, those requirements are only for the places that you're allowed to return from if you're not a U.S. citizen. Odd that it can be Caribbean islands, but not places like the U.K. and Europe. So does that play out also in terms of people's exposure, the business travel type hotel groups that have more exposure to those European destinations that you're not even allowed to return from, even if you've been tested? Are they suffering more accordingly?
Yeah, that's a great point. If you're trying to plan a trip to go overseas, you really need to check the restrictions that are currently in place. Currently, countries from the UK, major parts across Europe, and even Brazil, there are travel restrictions that are in place. Those protocols were put into place by the Biden administration. So, yes, that is something that you have to take into account. But if any traveler is returning to the United States, this new ruling does apply to them. You have to present a negative COVID test prior to departure. Take that test 72 hours before your flight.
Seema, thanks so much for that. Still to come, Prestige Ameritech, one of the only U.S. manufacturers of personal protective equipment. We'll talk to the company about what President Biden's mask mandate and Made in America executive order mean for the PPE maker next. And from the changing face of pension funds to bubble potential in ESG investments. BlackRock CEO Larry Fink is all in on ESG. We will dig into the tectonic shift, as he described it, coming up. The Exchange, we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. Markets right now essentially flat, as you can see. A little bit of gains for all three of the major averages, but nothing too serious. Let's have a look at the sectors, though, as well. We're seeing the likes of real estate and communication services top, energy, utilities, materials bottom. Slightly odd mix, therefore. Technology somewhere in the middle of the pack. Of course, a lot of earnings reports coming over the next couple of days from that sector. Here are some of the individual market movers at this hour. Industrials showing some strength. 3M higher on solid earnings, thanks to an increase in demand for its healthcare products during the pandemic. GE, on the other hand, reported mixed results and gave weak guidance. However, the beleaguered company said it will have positive industrial free cash flow, giving the stock a bit of a boost. I don't know which way I'm looking here. And next, UBS delivered a good quarter, reporting its highest annual pre-tax profit since 2006. The bank benefited from bumper trading volumes as well as strong lending to its ultra-rich clients. Shares of UBS are up about 3% or so today. And have a look at GameStop. Simply won't stop, up double digits, with trading briefly halted yet again earlier today. It's up about 40%, hovering just about 6% below its all-time high since retail investors from Reddit started a short squeeze on GameStop. Shares are up some 400% so far this year. Time now for a CNBC News update. Sue Herrera has it for us. Hey, Sue.
Good to see you, Will. Here's what's happening at this hour, everyone. The Senate has confirmed Antony Blinken as the next Secretary of State with a bipartisan vote of 78-22. Blinken is a longtime confidant of President Biden. Internet outages are being reported by numerous users all across the Northeast. Verizon has reported a fiber cut in Brooklyn, New York, though it's not clear yet if that issue is responsible for all of the outages. Verizon has not given an estimated repair time either. The TSA said it confiscated twice as many firearms at airport checkpoints in 2020 than it did in 2019. And this comes despite the huge decline in air travel because of the pandemic. Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson Airport had the most confiscations, with 220. And a judge has approved an updated Weinstein Company bankruptcy plan. It provides $17 million for victims of Harvey Weinstein and nearly $10 million for former company officials. To receive the full value of their claims, victims must agree to forego all legal claims against Weinstein. You are up to date, Wilf. Good to see you. I'll send it back to you.
Likewise, you, Sue. See you again later. President Biden issuing federal mask mandates and invoking the Defense Production Act as part of his administration's efforts in the fight against COVID-19. Meg Terrell joins us now with those details. Hey, Meg.
Hey, Wolf. Well, we've been hearing, of course, throughout this pandemic about the shortages of personal protective equipment and, of course, those N95 masks. Well, there's been a big focus on trying to establish more of a supply chain here in the United States for those. And President Biden yesterday signing an executive order focused on Made in America. That's for really everything, especially across government contracts. As part of that executive order, the president is creating a director of Made in America for the White House Office of Management and Budget, which would make waivers for buying American more difficult to get and would also make them public. As part of this EO, he also is pledging to replenish our stockpiles that have been such a focus during this pandemic, and for America to make its own personal protective equipment. Now, one of the players in that space who's been sounding the alarm on this for a long time is Prestige Ameritech and its Executive Vice President Mike Bowen, who joins us now. Mike testified in front of Congress back in May about how long you've been warning about this problem, that we don't make enough of this PPE here in the U.S. What has changed between May and now in that situation for you?
Having a new president is very exciting. The previous administration didn't take a scientific approach, and seeing Mr. Biden and his team take a scientific approach to this devastating issue is very exciting to us.
And you know, one of the things that you laid out was that, you know, during previous emergencies, in order to ramp up supply, you know, that takes time, that takes investment. And then if there isn't the follow through there and the purchasing, you're left, you know, having all of this ramp up and all of this investment, and it's financially very damaging to you. What kinds of contracts have you been striking now in the last few months? Do you have confidence in sort of this longer term manufacturing for this important equipment?
Yeah, the thing we did differently this time is we asked people to stay with us, and we had them sign contracts. So many hospitals across America have signed contracts with us for at least 2 years. This will allow us to know when the ramp down is going to happen, and it'll keep us from getting hurt like we did after the H1N1 pandemic in 2009 and 2010.
Well, you know, there's still a demand for N95s that seems like it can't be met. Tell us what, you know, what needs to happen in order to increase the supply of N95s? Is there a material that isn't, you know, isn't gettable? What would help with this situation to really expand that? As folks are talking about with these new variants being more contagious, the public needing better masks as well as healthcare workers.
We have never historically sold to the public, so we don't understand that market. The hospital market, however, is, at least from our vantage point, seems to be okay. We have, at this point, we have about 5 million more masks that we're making than we are selling. So we're actively looking for customers at this point. So the N95 shortage in the hospital, I don't see.
So 5 million more N95 masks you're making than you are selling. Is there a way to pivot then to supply that to the public, or is there some kind of disconnect in actually getting out to these hospitals?
I'm not sure if there's a disconnect or if the shortage is ending, because, you know, until a month ago, our phones were ringing off the wall and my email was filling up hourly. That's not happening now. And we have all the major distributors. We're known by most of the hospitals, and we're just seeing the need taper off. Now, again, we're not in the retail market. If President Biden wants us to help that that market, we'd love to try.
All right, Mike Bowen, we'll leave it there, but we appreciate you being with us, and we'll be sure to check back in. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Wilf, sending it back to you.
Meg, Mike, both thank you very much. Still ahead, the San Francisco 49ers are hoping to strike gold in England, making a big bet on the English Premier League by increasing their stake in Leeds United. That story and interview coming up. But first, consumer confidence climbing slightly in January as some Americans received a second round of stimulus checks. Steve Odland, CEO of the Conference Board, weighs in on what a third round of aid would mean for spending. That's next. The Exchange back in a couple. Welcome back to The Exchange. Consumer confidence rebounding in January after falling for two straight months. A new Conference Board survey shows consumers are worried about current business and labor market conditions, but are more optimistic about the future. Also, the number of consumers planning to buy a home in the next 6 months increased, suggesting the pace of home sales should remain robust. Joining me now for more on this is Steve Odland, President and CEO of the Conference Board and a CNBC contributor. Steve, very good afternoon to you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Wolf.
So sum up the scale of this data this morning, the consumer confidence reading coming in 89.3, ahead of expectations and nicely ahead of December as well.
Yeah, no, look, it's a 2-point increase. It's up versus down, which is what we've had the last couple of months. So this is better. But the Conference Board's measure has two components to it in consumer confidence. One is how consumers are feeling about their present situation, and the second, how they're feeling about the future. And the numbers on the present situation actually went down a little bit in January. So people are nervous about their jobs, they're nervous about their own financial conditions, and they are worried that business conditions actually are worsening right now. But as they look out over the next 6 months, they think it's actually going to get better. Part of that is driven by their views of the stimulus, and part of it is driven by their views of vaccinations and the ability then to get back to normal.
Clearly, discussions are ongoing in Washington about the stimulus. How much could these numbers drop, Steve, if we didn't get the full $1.9 trillion or we didn't get the full $1,400 stimulus checks?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, we want to get this number back over 100 where people start buying again, but they need to have some certainty in their own income. And even with the stimulus check in hand, they don't know if it's the last one they're going to see. They don't know how much, you know, it's how fast things are going to get back to normal. The main important thing for us to worry about is jobs. And so, you know, people want to work. It's a, you know, it's basically how they can afford to maintain their households and, you know, their level of spending. So that's where our focus needs to be. In order to get people back to work, we need to get people vaccinated. We need to get a herd immunity going. So it all comes back to COVID, and how fast can we get this vaccination through our society.
Steve, the housing market, of course, has been very strong despite a relatively weak economy over the last year. Do you think the numbers this morning suggest that will continue in the short term?
Well, you know, the housing market's been really strong. Now, part of that's been because of falling mortgage rates, and we've got, we're about as low as they've ever been. At some point, that peels off a lot of demand, and then you run up against, you know, fundamentally people being able to afford it. So, you know, that's one of the issues. The other thing we saw was a rotation out of rental housing and out of urban centers and more into suburban situations. That's COVID-driven as well. So it's going to be a turn of events if we can get back to some semblance of normal, some back in the office routine. Then people, I think, will stabilize and, you know, and not be counting so much on remote work.
And Steve, what's your latest take on consumers' incentive to spend versus save, even if we don't necessarily see the full stimulus measures? If confidence change, if mentality changes, how much ammunition is there that could be deployed into the economy or even into the stock market?
Well, you know, the stock market has a lot of cash still sitting on the sidelines, and we're into a new year, so all of that, those pension fund monies come in and so forth. So, you know, the question of whether this is a bubble or not is, you know, is a good one, but there's still a lot of cash out there. And where are you going to put it? I mean, bonds are not returning here. So, and, you know, at some point, you know, it becomes problematic. But then it comes right back to jobs again. And if people can find the certainty of their job and if people are getting back to normal, I think they'll go back and start spending again. You also have to deal with the consumer debt levels and student debt levels, which have been quite high. Now, they've been, you know, consumers are worried, so they've been paying down debt a little bit. But, you know, if they're more certain, they can go back and borrow again. So there, you know, there are some puts and takes here. I think it all comes back to confidence. And, you know, if you're looking at an administration plan, certainly the stimulus is important, but it's not about distribution of the vaccine. It's about production. You know, at a million a day, you know, we have 330 million people. They need two doses apiece. We need 660 million shots. At a million a day, it's good, but, you know, that's going to take too long. So the government needs to focus on production and helping those companies produce rather than worrying about the distribution, which seems to be keeping up with production.
Steve Oldham, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Wolf.
S&P 500 currently just about flat, positive by 7 basis points. Well off the session lows, had been down below 3,800 briefly at 3,858 as we speak. Coming up, he's been called one of the most influential investors in the market with nearly $9 trillion under management. BlackRock's Larry Fink out with his annual letter to CEOs and vows tougher climate scrutiny when deciding their next investment. We'll hear from him on that and whether ESG investing is approaching a bubble. We're back after this. Welcome back. BlackRock CEO Larry Fink releasing his annual letter to CEOs today and promising tougher climate scrutiny of companies before making investments. As the world's largest asset manager, BlackRock's size gives it major influence in this area. Andrew Ross Sorkin spoke with Larry Fink earlier and joins us now with the highlights. Andrew, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks, Wolf. It's great to see you. This year, Larry Fink calling on companies to disclose and report their path towards a net zero carbon footprint. In an interview, I asked Larry Fink about the investment products that BlackRock is building based on sustainability and this data, and over time, whether he thinks that indexes like the S&P 500 will actually have less significance.
To me, this is part of that Teutonic shift. I actually believe more of the public pension funds who have been pretty loud related to sustainability are going to move large pools of their money away from the traditional index to a more customized index that meet their participants' desires and needs. And we will have that technology and ability to do that.
I also asked Larry Fink whether he thinks there's too few public companies that actually fit the sustainability model and whether as a result there might be a bubble in ESG companies right now.
Well, a bubble means that it's going to burst anytime soon. And the amount of money that we are seeing that's moving into this space is going to continue. So for those who think we may have a bubble, there may be one or two stocks that we may have bubbles. But what I see is more and more companies and management teams are trying to move towards this space faster, not slower. And so we'll know in the next 5 years, you know, there will be some failures. I'm not here to suggest that everything is going to be rising perfectly. Like in everything else, when there's a new trend, we have huge winners and then we have some losers. And we will have that in this space too. But when you think about some of the great technology companies, when I think about some of the technology companies over the last 20 years, some of them were trading at 100 plus PEs and their earnings grew into those PEs, and now they're trading at whatever today, 27, 35 type of PEs.
Unclear whether he was alluding to Tesla there, but that is one company that may be the exemplar of a company that has fit under this sustainability umbrella that has gotten a lot of attention and, of course, some people believe is in bubble territory. Wolf?
Yeah, and clearly a lot of the energy companies aren't in bubble territory, so there's a nice dichotomy there. To play devil's advocate a little bit, Andrew, clearly the cynic would say, well, why have they continued to hold companies like, for example, Exxon over the last decade? Is it so that they can engage with the company and try and make them change their behavior? Or was the driving factor actually, we'll own the company because we think we'll make money doing so? And each year, have they only done the sort of bare minimum required to sort of justify why right. It's okay to hold that company and still say you're pro-climate change. And I, just to add one final point on it, I guess if this was his first letter on the topic saying, if they don't change, we'll vote with our feet, fine. But this has been going on for quite a long time, and they haven't voted with their feet, and they still do own these right. These companies.
So I think that I don't want to speak for Larry Fink. I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is, the company has $9 trillion under management. Only about four of that is actively managed. So a huge portion of that means that it is in a passive category, from what I understand. And as a result, you can't divest those shares so easily. If somebody owns the S&P 500, you own the S&P 500. So the big issue is, how do they handle it in the context of active management? The issue you raised, I think, is an important one, though, which is, if you own something, is it better to own it and try to work behind the scenes to make things better, or is it better to get rid of it? And I think that there's a real ongoing debate about that. The company, BlackRock, that is, did vote against about 69 different companies last year, 64 different directors, and has about 191 companies on what they call their watch list. So I think we're going to have to see how this plays out over time. I also think, you know, Larry Fink started talking about climate really in earnest just last year in a very meaningful way, one of the first in the context of big investors. And so I think we're just at the early innings, if you will, of this game. I know that's not fast enough for a lot of folks out there and a lot of environmentalists and others who have been critical of BlackRock and so many other investors for a very long time. But I do think this is a journey, and I think it's the beginning of one.
I totally get that point, Andrew, and clearly I know you're not here to speak for them. I think the debate comes on how long the journey's been going on for. I mean, back in my days as a fund manager, the firm I worked for launched an ESG-specific fund, and I think back then the argument was, if you want to invest in an ESG way, you can, and that means we won't own any of these right. Types of stocks in that fund, whereas now I feel like the argument is a little bit, you know, all of our investing is under the lens of ESG, but no longer does that mean you can't own the stocks. It means
so
you just
maybe
have to engage with the company.
Maybe here's the distinction, Wilf. I think really over the last, call it 24 months, green investing has now become profitable investing, which is to say that for a very long time, it wasn't clear that there was genuine performance related to it. And it's also clear that there's been a shift in the mindset of so many investors around the world around this issue. And so you see that capital going towards companies that do have sustainability programs and being pulled away from companies that don't. And that is actually a sea change. So maybe you could say Larry Fink is ahead of the game. Maybe he's just following the trend, but he's clearly become a voice for it.
I totally agree with that, Andrew. And I know we're kind of coming up on the clock, but if the motivation is because it's become profitable, it kind of speaks to my point as to why these big companies have started to change the position in the way they invest. Is it because they're doing it for human good, or is it because it's become the way to make money and that's what's forcing them to change? Either way, it's a great debate, and it was a great interview this morning. And the Dealbook article as well last night, Andrew, that preceded it was well worth a read. So check that out. Andrew Ross Sorkin, thank you very much.
Thanks, Will.
Still ahead, the San Francisco 49ers upping their stake in the English Premier League by buying a bigger stake in Leeds United. We'll talk to the incoming vice chair about that move coming up. Welcome back. The investment arm of the San Francisco 49ers is increasing its minority stake in English Premier League team Leeds United to nearly 40%. For more, I'm joined by Parag Marathe, president of the 49ers Enterprises and the new vice chair of Leeds United. And Parag, I know Leeds United are actually playing as we speak. It's half time, though, so thank you for finding the time. And I probably shouldn't show that. Wait, I've got to hold it this way, do I? There we go. My mouse mat is an Arsenal mouse mat, but shows my level of commitment to Arsenal. But thanks for joining us.
Yes, of course. Thanks for having me. And it's perfect timing. It just got to halftime.
Yeah. So I'm really interesting that you're upping this stake. And I wanted to start by asking why valuations are different. I could just Googled Manchester United listed on the New York Stock Exchange is worth $2.4 billion at the moment, sort of half of what an NFL team tends to trade for. And, you know, of course, both valuations very well. Why do you have such a big gap? Because there's not such a big gap in the revenues.
Yeah, you know, obviously in the UK, with the promotion relegation system, that comes with it a little bit of risk. And so as there is the relegation piece of it, and so the more you can show you can stay sustainably competitive within the Premier League, the better your valuation and the more you can matriculate up the table. So I do feel like there is a, for Leeds, for example, as long as we can continue to show promise and competitiveness in the Premier League, the valuation will continue to rise. As for the difference between the NFL and the Premier League, I can't necessarily speak to that specifically, but certainly Premier League valuations are right up there with some of the other top American sports leagues.
And as you said, Leeds, of course, recently promoted, and so they've got some work to do to be established long-term at not being a relegation threat. What is the valuation you've paid today, and where do you think it could get in the next 5 years?
You know, we don't go into the specifics of where we are today, but I can say that the sky is the limit for Leeds. I mean, clearly, this is a club with a remarkable history, with great bones, with a global fan base. I mean, look back 40 years ago or again 20 years ago, and Leeds was one of the most popular clubs in all of the world. And that fan base is almost there's a dormant amount of kinetic energy there ready to explode. And all we need, we've already shown that we belong. And we just need to sustain that competitiveness, and I think the sky's the limit for us.
The Premier League has seen remarkable price inflation for TV rights, both for the domestic UK rights and the global rights over the last decade and on the sort of three-year rotation when they auctioned them off. And parent company Comcast very involved with that, with Sky in the UK and NBC Sports here. Can that inflation continue, or has the rise been too severe? And do you see the streamers, the likes of Amazon, who started to get a taste of Premier League action recently, stepping up in a big way?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's a misnomer to say it's inflation. It's more passion that's growing at all. This is just an increase in passion. And I think you had a previous guest just a few minutes ago talk about how consumer confidence is going to come back months after vaccine. And I think professional sports are going to come roaring back. And frankly, I believe they're going to come back to pre-COVID, exceed that of pre-COVID levels. And I feel like whatever formats people want to consume their Premier League football, whether it be streaming, whether it be on linear programming, I think you'll see more and more, and I think it's going to come back even bigger.
Who's going to win next, the 49ers Super Bowl or Leeds United the Premier League title?
Hopefully both competing at the highest levels. The name of the game is being in the position to have a chance to win. So I think as long as you're competing at that top level, then anything can happen, and we have a good chance.
Well, Parag, I'll let you get back to watching the second half. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for the time.
Much appreciated.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.